Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And here are a few ways the President Trump era is beginning in New York. Swastikas were found scrawled on four dorm room doors at the New School, according to the Daily News. A Facebook post shows an image of the word Trump scrawled onto the door of a Muslim prayer room at NYU's engineering school, according to the local news site Gothamist. And Governor Cuomo announced investigations into two more alleged swastika incidents. A resident at SUNY Geneseo reported a swastika and the word Trump written outside the university's Nassau residence hall. The other involves a swastika painted onto the side of a softball dugout in Wellsville, New York, plus the words Make America White Again, according to a photo from the Wellsville Daily Reporter. These are some local examples of expressions of hate being reported around the country. On Sunday, the president-elect sent mixed messages about his response. In his 60 Minutes interview, he sounded like he hadn't been hearing about any incidents.
I'm very surprised to hear that.
I hate to hear that. I saw one or two instances.
I think it's a very small amount. Again, I think it's the media.
Do you want to say anything to those people?
I would say don't do it. That's terrible. Because I'm going to bring this country together.
They're harassing Latinos, Muslims.
I am so saddened to hear that. And I say stop it. If it helps, I will say this, and I'll say it right to the camera, stop it.
Stop it, he told haters, with Leslie Stahl there on 60 Minutes invoking his name to stop it. That was more direct than his denunciations of David Duke or the alt-right during the campaign, so maybe that's encouraging. But Trump also appointed Steve Bannon, who ran Breitbart News until he joined the campaign, to be his senior counselor and chief strategist yesterday. Headlines on Breitbart yesterday included wave of fake hate crimes sweep social media. Reportedly, a few have been revealed to be hoaxes, but Breitbart does not acknowledge that a wave of real hate crimes might also be in progress, and its leader is now a Trump advisor. Another Breitbart headline, anti-democracy crybabies march by thousands nationwide. Not anti-Trump, anti-democracy, as protesters exercise their democratic rights. So all that is one way the President Trump era is beginning. Another is that he is beginning to face reality about the complexities of governing as opposed to campaigning. On Obamacare, after speaking to Obama,
what I really wanted to focus on was Middle East, North Korea. Obamacare is tough. You know, health care is a tough situation right now.
On the spate of lobbyists on his transition team after he ran on a promise to drain the swamp of special interest lobbyists?
I don't like it, no.
You don't like it. But your own transition team is filled with lobbyists.
It's the only people you have down there.
You have lobbyists from Verizon. You have lobbyists from the oil gas industry.
Sure.
You have food lobbyists.
Everybody's a lobbyist down there. That's what they are. They're lobbyists, they're special
interests. On your own transition team.
And he vowed again to destroy ISIS while still denouncing the expense of fighting in Iraq.
We've spent $6 trillion in the Middle East. $6 trillion. We could have rebuilt our country twice.
And by the way, on losing the popular vote to Hillary Clinton?
I would rather see it where you went with simple votes. You know, you get 100 million votes and somebody else gets 90 million votes and you win.
Let the debate about a national popular vote and abolishment of the abolition of the Electoral College begin. I guess President-elect Trump is on the record for it now. All of those clips were from his 60 Minutes interview with Leslie Stahl. So what should the progressive response be to the beginning of the Trump era? Is there a way to work together or only to resist on the part of progressives? My first guest today is Heather McGee, president of the progressive think tank Demos, based here in New York. Among many other things, she was in charge of domestic and economic policy for John Edwards' presidential campaign in 2008 and helped to shape some provisions of the Dodd-Frank banking law after the financial crisis in 2009. Heather, thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
And listeners, our phones are open no matter who you voted for or your reactions to the 60 Minutes interview or anything else from the first few days of the transition and to what's going on with hate speech or in the protests or anything. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Heather, before we even get to policy, we have to deal with the issue of public safety after the election. Invest in swastikas, I guess, based on the incidents being described here in New York. Here's one more very short clip. This is Donald Trump Jr. when he joined the 60 Minutes interview.
I think the fears, you know, while they may be there, some fabricated, some not, are totally unfounded.
So how encouraged or not are you by the president-elect and his family's response?
It is saddening, unacceptable, and outrageous that this message of hate is having the megaphone of the highest office.
He said, stop it. He looked into the camera and he said, stop it.
He said, stop it, to Leslie Stahl and to the camera, and meanwhile put Steve Bannon, who's a white supremacist, anti-Semitic sort of media empire, has fundamentally unleashed forces in this country that are not just, and this is the sad part, that are not just inviting people who hold these really hateful, bigoted ideas to sort of come out into the open, but they're also shaping the tenor of our everyday interactions, of schools where I was just talking with a friend yesterday whose niece went to school, and the school is about 50% Latino, and the kid got on the table and screamed, "All the Mexicans have to go home now." And when she stood up to say that that wasn't true, you know, tears in her eyes, the principal, you know, put her in detention. We're seeing these kinds of just shifts in the norms of what is acceptable all over the country. And I think right now it's so important for the millions, the majority of Americans in the middle right now who feel like this is, they feel like they woke up in a country that they don't recognize, to do more than they ever have in terms of solidarity. Some people are beginning to wear safety pins on their lapels and blazers and sweaters, and that's important because it shows just quietly when you're on the subway that a woman in a hijab is safe sitting next to you, for example. That is the kind of little thing we can do, and then there has to be a lot more that we can do. This is a moment, I think, for everyone who may not have been politicized in the past to really join organizations, to organize in their communities, to make our local elected officials be non-compliant with the Trump agenda, as folks are doing in New York City already. It is a time for everyone to say, whose side are we on?
Anne in Park Slope, you're on WNYC. Hi, Anne.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you.
This conversation is so distressing to me, and it's a really, really slippery slope here. You know, we elected a president who gave validation to hate. One of the reasons we were able to do that was because the media kind of formed this narrative that enabled this scenario. Is the media not enabling and inflaming with the constant promotion of these hate crimes? I'm looking at this and I'm going, I know that the hate crimes exist, but is the media not shifting to this narrative instead of taking a bit more responsibility and curbing the language and vetting the sources? I saw this morning a horrible sign that was making its way all over the internet, a very inflammatory sign on a house in California. Turns out this house was owned by a man who posted this sign that posted against his own people. But it's made its way all the way around the world before we ever get back to the source.
Right. And that's a risk with social media, which is person to person and not vetted by editors, et cetera. But what are you suggesting, Anne, if you're thinking something in particular with respect to professional media organizations like ours or any other, to not report it or downplay it?
I would suggest that people are finding celebrity in really, really weird, sick, racist sources. People will go to all sorts of lengths to get on camera, to get online, to be on the radio. And I think that it's time for the media to start to assume some responsibility for knowing their power to inflame passion.
But I still don't get what you want the media to do. And let's just take my intro to this segment and where we've begun this morning, right here, right now. Would you prefer that we have started somewhere else or not listed some of the particular hate speech incidents that have been reported in our local area or Governor Cuomo's response to them?
Well, see, you know, hindsight's sort of 20/20. I wish that the media had been reporting the hate crimes that had been happening all the way leading up to the election so that this did not seem like such a conflated incident. Mm-hmm.
And thank you very much. And we do also need to acknowledge that there are some things going on in the other direction. And Jeremy in Morris County wants to point out one of those. Jeremy, thank you very much for calling. You're on WNYC.
Geez, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just want to point out that as far as Trump saying some of them are hoaxes, there was one in California where a woman claimed she had her hijab ripped off by a couple of white men. Turns out she made up the entire thing, which is despicable. And speech and actions are two entirely different things. There was a Chicago Trump voter who got beat badly on video. They were laughing about it and was posted onto the web. There was also an incident in California where a Trump voter, also by two assailants, got beat up. I don't hear about any Trump people beating up anybody that voted for Hillary. Now, I'm not saying that drawing swastikas is okay or that hate speech is okay. It's not. But saying something and doing something, assaulting someone because of their political views is just totally against any sort of democratic principles. I think you would agree.
Absolutely agree. Jeremy, thank you very much. So, Heather McGee from Demos, this is the complex and really kind of tragic situation that the country is in.
It is, and I just think it's really important for us to acknowledge the caller, you know, said that words are different than actions, but words inspire actions. And one of the first times I really realized the extent to which Donald Trump's creation of a connection between the anxiety, the outrage, the distance that people feel from the decision makers in their state capitals and in Washington, the anxiety they feel about the fact that they are not sure that they're going to be able to support their families. Donald Trump connected that to the presence in this country of other people, people of color, people with even less power than his core voters have. And the first time I realized the threat, the physical threat that this created, you may remember almost a year ago now in Boston when a couple of young men beat a homeless man of Latino descent and said, you know, make America great again. And you saw Donald Trump have to respond to that. And he said, well, you know, my supporters are, I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically said, you know, my supporters really love America. And so I think you're going to see more pressure on him to repudiate what is happening across the country, but it is hard to put a genie back in the bottle when you, every time from the first time that you announced your race for president, you said that Mexican immigrants were rapists and criminals, to the final debate when you said, you know, there are bad hombres in this country. It's going to be very hard for him to turn around and then say that people who have now been convinced that the threat to them is not, you know, billionaires who don't care about them and are stealing the birthright of our children by flushing the American dream down the toilet, but rather it's, you know, working class people, struggling and striving immigrants, Muslims who come here searching for a better future from countries where they feel scared and oppressed. This is not the country that all of us sort of hold in our hearts to be what is worth fighting for, what is worth striving for, what is worth creating together. And I'm very worried that right now we're going to see this tit for tat on fundamental questions of how we treat one another and who belongs in this country, where people who may have voted for Trump because they wanted to send a middle finger to the system, and maybe rightly so, given how much economic and political inequality there is right now, are now feeling like they have to defend hate crimes.
Susan in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning. I called in today to point out that I'm a big fan of your station, and like a lot of your callers and guests, I voted for Hillary. I was shocked and disappointed to find out the outcome. But I just have observed that you have very few voices from people who are longtime, you know, multi-generational residents of either New York or even America. I mean, I happen to be a part of a tiny minority, which is a 10th generation New Jerseyan. And I know a lot of people who, you know, still believe in the American dream and strive for it and kind of see that they and their generations have been patient and patiently waiting for it and working hard and serving their country and volunteering and giving money and time and every other thing to build a wonderful community. And then they see people arrive, recent arrivals who sort of start kind of compromising the cultural qualities of these communities. And
well, what do you mean by cultural qualities? I mean, I think that almost all the guests we have on this show believe passionately in the American dream, and most are multi-generational Americans, and many are from more recent immigrant families. My family is only here 3 generations, including me. But Susan, what do you mean changing the cultural fabric?
For instance, teachers getting cultural sensitivity training about a particular group that comes into their town or their neighborhood. And the question is really whether the immigrants are being given the proper cultural sensitivity training about being in America. I don't know of any group or organization that is proactively doing that.
Well, what do you see happening maybe in your community, if you're having firsthand experience of this, that that makes you concerned about what the immigrants are doing? Because you know a lot of people are listening to you and thinking, oh, this is just a prejudiced woman.
Well, that would be a sad thing for sure. Well, you know, the nurse who sees the wealthy immigrant doctor bringing family members to the clinic instead of paying for the medical care, obviously wealthy enough to do so, and the nurse is struggling. Or the
instead of paying for the medical care?
Yes, using a publicly funded clinic for a family member rather than paying for the medical care and taking responsibility for the family member. I think you look at the case of Ravi, the student at Rutgers who tormented his gay roommate, and the arrogance toward diversity and, you know, the respecting, you know, your fellow classmate, and that individual, you know, was not deported, which I think really disturbs a lot of people who have to send their children to Rutgers and have to have them surrounded by attitudes like that.
And so you think he did that because he was an immigrant rather than he was anti-gay, which you can find in this country as well.
Yes.
Why do you come to that conclusion?
Well, because of the that community delivers cultural sensitivity training to teachers, and there's an arrogance there. I guess it's their way of coping with the unfamiliarity of America.
Susan, thank you for your call. Heather from Demos, do you want to reply to Susan at all?
I do, actually, because I think it's important, and I appreciate, Brian, that you gave her, you know, a full airing and engaged. When we, as people who want to see a new American dream that actually includes all of us, are not having cultural conversations about the myths, the anxieties, the fears. And by that, I mean so many Democrats and progressives who have just are, you know, white liberals and are kind of nervous about talking about race and certainly about talking about race to other white people. Then we leave that entire terrain open to, you know, at worst, the Donald Trumps and Steve Bannons, and at best, the folks who are just making conclusions about what they, you know, what they don't know. And that we all do that. We absolutely all do that. That's the kind of the definition of having, you know, not being exposed and deeply have relationships with other communities. We are still a very segregated place, and making conclusions based on, you know, very shallow knowledge. I'll say that the it was hard for me to hear her kind of make a distinction between what I am assuming is her, you know, sort of white origins in this country and being multi-generational. I'm the descendant of slaves who built this country under conditions of bondage and torture. And so I had to sort of just myself, like, emotionally react to being sort of excluded from the idea of who helped build this country and who's a real American. Without my ancestors' labor, you know, this economy would not have existed. So I had to have that. I'll just be personal. I had to have that emotional reaction. But finally, I was able to sort of hear what she was saying and be able to recognize that this is where we need to have community-based dialogues, right? The idea that immigrants who are coming into this country where American cultural values have been broadcast around the world, you know, for a century, where every single cultural touchstone that we interact with, our economy, our society, our media, is reflecting American values and systems, and sort of unspoken mores. Do we need civics classes in this country so that everyone understands the American way of government? Yes. But the idea that it's somehow unfair or arrogant to ask that the people who are, you know, living and swimming in American culture get to know a little bit about the people who are coming to this country as, you know, guests and future citizens, that that's somehow arrogant, or that somehow immigrants are not doing their part to learn about America and assimilate. It really means that we need to do much more work at the community level. And I will just say that I hope that that is one silver lining from this moment when so many people woke up on Wednesday and felt like they were not politicized, but that they really needed to do something different and join something that people would be willing, that we'll see a real uptick in membership and community organizations where people can have that kind of intercultural dialogue.
My guest is Heather McGee, president of the progressive think tank Demos. To that point, before we take another call, for you as a progressive opinion leader and Demos as a progressive policy institution, what's your reaction to this? Frank Bruni wrote in the New York Times today in his column, from the presidential race on down, Democrats adopted a strategy of inclusiveness that excluded a hefty share of Americans and consigned many to a basket of deplorables who aren't all deplorable. Some are hurt, some are confused. Liberals miss this by being illiberal, Frank Bruni wrote. Is that one reason for Trump's election, and should your policy concerns expand in any way to acknowledge the political failure and what underlies it?
So I think that the thing that would have connected the most with the members of the, you know, majority of white voters who voted for Donald Trump were off the table because of some structural problems in the Democratic Party. What do I mean by that?
Donald Trump ran as a racist and a sexist and also as a populist. And his populist indictment of our trade policies that were crafted through the Clinton administration, the first Clinton administration, and which till today were being advanced by Democrats in a rejection of where their own base, whether it's labor unions or people of color and women who are really reeling from an economy where the rules are written by corporations and the wealthy. Democrats did not follow their own base and their own real understanding of what is going on in the economy with a strong populist message. Democrats, the Clinton campaign, had an agenda that included things that would have transformed the lives of people in the Rust Belt, whether it was the biggest jobs and infrastructure bill ever proposed, or the issue that Demos worked on, making all public colleges debt-free for working and middle-class families, raising the minimum wage, child care. All of these ideas were on the website, but they weren't part of the thrust of the campaign. I think that was a fatal mistake, because they saw that what Donald Trump was talking about was so evident, this racism and sexism, that they felt like if they could appeal to women and people of color just on keeping the worst possible threat to their dignity out of the White House, that they didn't have to confront hard truths about what was the Clinton revolution within the Democratic Party, which was one where we really sided with against labor and the working class of all races, and made an economic order that included the kind of trade deals that have really decimated the American manufacturing sector, and not standing up enough for the idea that what we've replaced it with, the service sector, needs to also be good jobs. So we have a lot, I think, as progressives to do to make sure that the phony populism of Donald Trump is not the only populism that voters can choose between.
Ashley in Hawthorne, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Ashley.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure.
So I was calling in response to the caller, Susan, that called a bit earlier today. I'm a first-generation Puerto Rican-American, and I know that Puerto Ricans are considered American, but the culture is very different. And when my parents moved here and when my grandparents moved here, when my grandmother moved here and brought her kids here, it was very difficult for them to assimilate to the culture. And my mother, to this day, still sees moments where her culture that she was raised with clashes with the American culture, but she tries really hard to assimilate. And I don't think it's always evident that she does, but she really is trying. And I was a bit disheartened when I listened to Susan, at least it felt to me, that she was blaming the immigrants for not assimilating, or blaming us as a people for not educating them on our culture. There are so many things that they have to learn to begin with when they come here. Our system, our language, and little by little they learn the culture, but to blame everything that they do wrong on their cultural insensitivity was disheartening to me, I think. But I'm glad that you gave her the opportunity to speak, because it allowed me to see what is out there in the conversations I have to engage in with other people.
And more so now, because I think more people like Susan, who may not have even called in the past, feel empowered to call and make their voices public on feelings like she had.
Correct. And I've seen in my own family where my aunt married an Italian-American man, and his views, I mean, they were Trump supporters, his views on immigration and Latino culture was a bit disheartening to me, because he'd been married into this family for over 27 years. And I didn't know that he felt that way, because he didn't feel legitimized to express that. And I feel that Trump and his rhetoric has made those people feel legitimized, has made them feel that it's okay to speak that way when you're outside of your house. And in a way, it's harmful because now people are afraid, then in a way it's good because it opens up a dialogue. And if we decide to speak and to engage instead of fighting, perhaps we can achieve something. What that is, I don't know, but I choose the side of peace and discussion, and I just hope that we can achieve something, despite how disheartened I felt after this election.
Well, we'll certainly keep having those discussions here. So, Ashley, thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. And let's go on to Noreen in Manhattan. Noreen, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Mm-hmm.
I simply do not understand why more pressure is not being put on the Electoral College. We still have time to get Hillary. She's won the popular vote. And this is what our country is based on, the popular vote. One person, one vote. And that should be taken into consideration. We're spending an awful lot of time analyzing what happened. And it seems to me that there's still time to do something about what happened. The Electoral College needs to have some pressure put on it to take into consideration a little bit more seriously the popular vote of the American people.
Noreen, thank you very much. Well, Heather McGee, on the Electoral College, for one thing, I think in fairness, this campaign was run with the system that we have in place. And if there was a national popular vote system for electing the president, both campaigns probably would have been run very differently. And we can't say because Hillary Clinton won the popular vote under this system that she would have won the popular vote or not if they were really actually running that way. It would have been an entirely different campaign. If you disagree, say so. But I do also see where I believe you have called the Electoral College system racist. Is that right?
The Electoral College system, like much of the peculiarities of our democratic system in this country, was created in order to maintain a balance as a slavery compromise, right? So we have, I think, at Demos, we think a lot about the issues today that we struggle with in not having a truly representative democracy, having a patchwork voting system of laws at all 50 states and laws like photo ID requirements and even just the requirement that you register 30 or 15 days ahead of time when, in fact, the capacity exists to be able to register on the day that you vote, are all laws, many of which were really created at a time when the political aim was to make sure that either there was a balance of power between the slaveholding states and the free states, or after Reconstruction were created to ensure that the newly freed slaves, did not have political power. So we have – this is just one of the many examples of the ways that our history of discrimination is still playing out in ways that affects not just the descendants of slaves or people of color today, but it really affects all of us. I think there are so many people who are not – who don't understand why it is that we have an Electoral College, who don't understand why it is so onerous to just register and vote, why it seems like our system is not at all as, kind of modern as many other countries. We have to look at the fact that many of our rules were created with a desire to exclude people from the vote, and that's what it's still doing today, not just people of color, but lots of people who are finding it harder to have their voices heard than it should be.
Certainly everybody in our listening area was, in effect, disenfranchised by the Electoral College system,
mm-hmm.
just by the accident of history that New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, everybody knows in advance how all three states are going to vote currently. Now, that isn't true in every election. That hasn't been true in every era of the country. But right now, nobody campaigned in New York or New Jersey or Connecticut because they knew what the outcome would be, which means everybody here's vote didn't matter. But by the same token, I'm sure you as an advocate of a broad-based democracy would maybe be skeptical of a simple winner-take-all national popular vote. And I don't know, maybe that's the best system to strive for. But you know that in majorities, where there's 50% plus one get all the power, people who are minorities in many different ways wind up without any power. That's why proportional representation is a progressive notion. And the Electoral College is one form of proportional representation, although not really representative in the context of America today. What would you like to see?
I think it's time for us to acknowledge that our democracy is still in progress, right? The idea of democracy is a really bold, beautiful, somewhat radical idea. The idea that we would all have an equal say in shaping the decisions that affect our lives, that we would have the ability to directly to elect people who are accountable ultimately to us for the big decisions that shape not just, you know, our lives, but the future of the planet and people across the country. That's always been a contest for power in this country. And right now, when we are at a generational axis moment where a country that was predominantly white in its population, although never exclusively, and the meaning of who got to be included in white was always changing. But a country that was predominantly white is changing to a country that more reflects what I think is, frankly, what makes us the most beautiful, which is that we're not a country that's just about one ethnic or racial group, but in fact that here in this this new world, we are holding the dream that we can all meet as equals, no matter what our race or ethnicity is. That is the question. So we've got to look at a future in which the racial hierarchies upon which the country was founded and organized for generations, we have to say whether or not we want to still hold to the institutions and the structures that was created to set up that value versus a new value and a new American identity that is inclusive. So I think that there are a lot of reforms that we need to see and seed in order to create the democracy for the America that we're becoming and not just America we have been. I think we could do that with proportional representation, not the Electoral College kind, which is really making proportional representation at the state line around rural and urban, which is not necessarily, you know, the value that we most need to hold, but rather the idea that we need to have multiple party choices in this country. You know, I think the Working Families Party in New York has been a very important force for defining exactly what it is that we want to see from our Democrats. And I think that we are going to enter into a moment of, into an era of real political volatility where there is somewhat of a crisis of confidence in the leadership in elites of all political stripes, and where the one thing that hasn't changed is the ability and the aspiration of people to join together to make their voices heard.
Maybe Maine and Nebraska are onto something, starting to allocate presidential electoral votes by congressional district, which is where the 538 electoral votes come from in the first place.
That's right.
Maybe there's something to that.
That's right. I think we can really be experimenting with ideas like that. There's a big move afoot for what they're calling sort of the interstate compact on the national popular vote. Maryland did it, just last week.
Which is what?
Which is the idea that without having to amend the Constitution or go through Congress, states can decide how to reapportion their electors in exactly that way.
Within state lines. Let me take, if you have time, one more phone call for you, because Vanessa in Reading is calling with an incident of, I don't know if you'll call it hate speech, Vanessa, but that has broken out in your own town's high school. Hi, Vanessa, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. I consider what was said in the high school hate speech. So a group of kids in, I heard, ninth grade, but also maybe another grade, were chanting, build the wall, on Wednesday, the day after the election.
Can I ask if there are any Latino children in that high school who might have had that directed at them even?
Well, Reading is very non-diverse. It's the high school is Reading and Easton. It's very white, upper middle class. But yes, there are people of different ethnicities, of different backgrounds, and different races. I was not told that it was directed specifically at anyone. Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make it okay, but it's particularly personally intimidating if there were. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yes, no, thanks. I spoke to one of the parents of one of the boys who I was told had done it, and I said, you know, this is hate speech. And he said, oh, no, it's just something ninth graders do. And I said, no, it's hate speech, because imagine if you are of Mexican or South American descent, and that is basically directed at you, how you would feel intimidated by it. And you can't just brush this off as something ninth graders do. It is hate speech and needs to be called out as such.
And so is the school district or the school principal taking any kind of action or sending a note? I know a lot of principals, apparently, and school districts are starting to say something to their parents and student populations.
I have not heard yet that the school is taking any action, but I guess we will find out within the next day or two. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, I think for me, I have a very personal dislike for the whole wall idea. I'm a first-generation American. My father's from Germany. And he grew up during the war. My family were Nazis, but they didn't leave. And they didn't have a voice but saw what was happening. My father's family was devout Catholic, and he was not allowed to attend the Pathfinders, which was like the Hitler Youth for the little kids. Mm-hmm. And after the war was finished, which they miraculously survived through starvation, and my grandmother was imprisoned. My family was in East Berlin, and they were in the Russian-occupied section, and my father, as a young teen with his brother, timed the guards at the train station, and they left their possessions in the middle of the night. So for me, a wall is very symbolic of many things, and mm-hmm. I fear the rise of fascism, and I fear the hate.
And I'll mention that the Anti-Defamation League officially protested the appointment of Steve Bannon to senior White House counselor because of things that have been in on his news site, Breitbart, such as calling the editor of the Weekly Standard, William Kristol, a renegade Jew. So, Vanessa, thank you for that echo of history. I really appreciate your phone call. And, boy, Heather, as we wrap this up, we are having some of the most unbelievably difficult conversations that a country can have right now.
Thank you.
Did you want to say anything else with respect to Vanessa? Then we got to go, and I'm
really
sure you got to go.
I really appreciated her sharing her story and her father's story, and I think that this country is full of many intergenerational stories. We bring so much to this pursuit of becoming one people, and I think it's now time for us to listen to one another much more deeply, to demand more from our elected officials. Donald Trump will be sworn in as president. He does not have a mandate to repeal the 20th century. He does not have a mandate to tie the hands of the richest nation on earth from addressing global climate change. He certainly does not have a mandate to assault our civil rights and liberties and attack immigrants, migrants, and refugees. The list continues. And so it's time for us to listen to each other and have a fair amount of backbone to be able to say that this is not the country that the majority of Americans support, and that we will make clear where the lines are drawn.
Heather McGee, president of Demos, thank you very much.